Okay, hello, I'm Gitesh, I'm the Assistant Director here at the Forums. First of all, I'm going to try and pass this around. It's for the official DragonCon community charity, the Atlanta Community Food Bank. If anyone wants to make a donation, our money, food and other toiletries and stuff are donated at the Sheraton. Pass that around. So let's get started with... minute or two early with what is it now? It's been a long con.
P2P.
P2P, copyright trolls and your privacy. I'd like to thank all of you for coming to the panel on a Monday lunchtime when I'm sure everybody want to go home, tired of the con, tired of these hotels, or trying to fight to get out of your room before they try to charge you again. I'm Gitesh, as I said. I am the senior researcher, lead researcher, and community manager at torrentfreak.com, where I obviously research about torrents and torrent data and BitTorrent clients and all that sort of thing. And I've covered copyright trolls in both the US and elsewhere in the world since around 2007.
And I'm Blair Chintella. I'm an attorney here. I've been practicing law involving copyright and specifically this trolling sort of business model for about 4 years now total. Can everybody hear me all right now? Okay. So I'm based in Decatur, but I've handled cases in other jurisdictions, even up in D.C., you know, where people get these subpoenas and such. In Georgia, it hasn't been that prevalent a problem, but... across the country, there are lots of these cases being filed, and I've handled a lot of wide range of them. So,
okay, we are of course recording this. So, if you've got a question, stick your hand up, and we'll throw you this microphone. I'll move to this one, and I'll pass it to the gentleman at the back, who'll hand it to you if needed.
So, the first thing I like to ask, usually, we've done this panel for 3 years now. And there's slightly less people here than there have been in previous years, so maybe...
We're a little later as well.
Oh, okay.
We usually have the slot before this.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, maybe that's a good indication that these, you know, they're filing less cases. But just out of curiosity, who here has ever received one of these threatening letters from their
lawyer,
ISP?
A lawyer, nasty gram, rather than through an ISP. Anybody? It's the first year we've had no responses.
It's the very first year, so...
How about just the email nastygram saying, we've detected you've downloaded something? Here we go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, your landlord got one, so, well, you got one. But, oh.
Well, it's good that they're like a shield for you then. So essentially what those are, like those emails especially... those most likely are sent in response to DMCA requests. That stands for the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and if you get those emails and you actually read through all the jargon, they'll usually reference that federal statute in there. And what the DMCA does is it allows the copyright owners to notify certain entities that their material is being infringed. And in theory, it's supposed to be for entities that are hosting the infringing content. So, for example, a website hoster or something like that where stuff is posted. But another sort of variation of these trolling models is to send it to the ISPs. Now, ISPs, they provide the internet connection, but they don't host the content. So right off the bat, the trolls are kind of abusing this federal authority. But, you know, ISPs, they're sort of scared about not complying with the DMC notice, and so they just forward these email notices to their customers. And it just so happens that as part of that notice, they include some settlement offers. Who here of the people who got these emails, did they include settlement offers, and if so, how much?
Just warnings. Just a warning, a stop, a cease and desist, essentially.
Or if you have a file name or a data attached, so we've detected, stop.
You're a bad person, stop it.
Exactly.
Okay. Anyhow, I get calls from people still here in Georgia and elsewhere asking about these emails where typically the new business model is to direct you to a website, and, you know, try and charge you $200 for a settlement, and then you don't necessarily get to see the actual written agreement. They just say, "Well, just send you a signed agreement."
Just sign it.
Right. Well, they don't say who signed it, whether the person has authority to sign it, and all the sort of legal requirements for a valid settlement.
They just want your money. That's all it is. It's a business proposition. It's a lot like the Nigerian letters. They just want to send it to you, or any kind of spam. They want to send it to you. They want to get the money. And if only a small percentage respond and get the money, that's still a lot of money because they send out a lot of notices.
Absolutely. I mean, it's economies of scale is the kind of way I explain it to clients, is that it would not work unless you sent it out to hundreds of thousands of subscribers.
And they do. I think one company, Malibu Media, has sent out something like 60% of all copyright infringement lawsuit filings in the US this year. And we're talking something like 200,000.
I'm not sure the
named people or claimed defendants through these mass lawsuits this year so far, 200,000 or so. I believe that was a number.
Yeah, it's kind of evolved over time. And so if you're familiar with it at all, there are a lot of people online who comment and they create graphics of these big trolls with clubs of this, you know, signifying this business model. But that sort of grew out of like its origins, where they would file lawsuits in like the District of Columbia or something.
Well, let's go right back to where the whole process first started in about 7-8 years ago in Europe. And it first started in Germany in 2006 or 2007, and then moved to the UK, where it kind of got really refined. In the UK, there's a company called Davenport Lines. They're a fairly established law firm, and they had this guy, and he was their evidence guy, and they went to him, they got the information, they started sending out these requests. Now, in the UK law, you've got this thing called the Norwich Farmacal Order, which is where they go to a special court called a Chancery Court, and they get the information. It's a special request to find out the names of people in this court, and only the ISPs can contest it, which they didn't, including Sky, which is part of the Fox umbrella. So you think about, that's the only one you'd really know over here, and Vodafone, which at the time owned Verizon, a substantial chunk of Verizon. But that went through, and people started getting demands, and they started with arcade pinball. In fact, it was a game, the first one. And then it started changing to other Atari games. And then there was a bit of an outcry, and Atari dropped them, and so they had to go for different content, and they ended up with some hardcore pornography. Now, the fun thing about that is, under the UK law, all pornography has to be licensed and certified by the British Board of Film Censors. That, in the US, motion picture ratings are completely optional. In the UK, they're not, and they have the force of law. They're done by a government, quasi-government agency called the BBFC, and they have to be certified by those. These works were so extreme that the BBFC refused to classify them. So the works are actually illegal for distribution in the UK, but these copyright trolls were claiming that people were distributing them and that were infringing their UK copyrights, which they could not have. So it started to get a lot of traction with the consumer associations, and then on BBC News consumer TV shows, and then Anonymous got involved a little, and they started DDoSing the lawsuit, the law firm's website, and the website went down, and then it kind of came back up, but what came up was actually a partial email record, a partial IMAP folder of emails between the lawyer at the heart of it and his tech guy and a few others. Basically, what they said was how they sorted it, which was, those who denied it, we'd send them another letter demanding. Those who really couldn't afford to pay and told us that, we kind of just put to one side and left them alone. and those that, you know, we thought could pay and thought we could get money out of, we just kept, you know, hammering and hammering and hammering. And they had no case. They avoided going to court, just like most of these trolls do. And in the end, the Solicitors Regulatory Agency, which is like the British version of the bar, took him for disciplinary proceedings, and he was disbarred for, I think, 2 years. And he was also slapped with a fine by the Information Commissioner, because one of the files included in the email database, the email IMAP folder, was names and addresses of people they were targeting. So he was slapped for having this public, this personally identifiable information. No, now we're onto the privacy aspect in some ways, that without having it encrypted and sending it in the plain text. And so he was fined by the Information Commissioner for violating privacy laws. So that kind of stopped it dead in the UK, and it's pretty much dead in the UK. Germany is weird. It kind of goes and fits and starts. A lot of the data collection companies that are in use in the US now are still based in Germany. Logistep and DigiProtect and a few others. But now it came to the US about 5 years ago?
I would say, yeah, probably about 4 or 5 years ago. The way it kind of started is that the business model was created to file these lawsuits, and they would name the title of the law, or the style of the lawsuit, as they say, would be like, you know, AF Holdings versus Doe's 1 through 10,000. And so in the complaint, they would say, you know, Exhibit A, here's 10,000 IP addresses.
That we just spotted on BitTorrent.
That we, through our extremely reliable and almost foolproof technology, detected. And we need discovery to uncover the identity of these people to sue them.
And so get it to us really quickly, so give us an ex parte motion.
Well, so sure, they file these motions, and ex parte meaning that no other party responds to it because they're not aware of it. They're not parties to the lawsuit. So, and depending on the jurisdiction, then the courts would either, you know, grant or deny the motion. And they use form shopping, of course. So if one jurisdiction, they have a bad record there, the judges don't like them, then they'll file it in D.C. or so. D.C. is sort of like the bane of my existence in a way. So like that's where all the lawsuits were filed, or the big ones, anyways.
And there's a reason for that. Let's get back in a bit.
But so like, I want to mention real quick, like so right off the bat, you know, they get 10,000 people's contact information. And one of the problems is that they don't really even try to narrow it down, for example, to people who actually live in D.C. And so, you know, that affects jurisdiction. So once they get the information, there's basically no intent there to actually name them in the lawsuit. The purpose is to get the information, send out settlement letters. And there are variations out there. They would use robocalling, just have machines call people. Some people would actually record these calls and post them on the internet. So you could hear like these extortionate tactics, like if you don't settle with us, then, you know, we're gonna take your children or something. And I mean, just like ridiculous, not like that, but you know, pretty bad stuff to especially someone who's not an attorney, just like, oh my God, you know, they'll pay $1,500 to these people who are harassing them for settlements. Then they would send out letters with all these kind of outrageous borderline misrepresentations about damages that could be collected, and that
how
kind
they
of thing.
Can be collected and what they have as proof.
Right. And then you know, they'll file token lawsuits. So after this lawsuit versus 10,000 people, then they'll file like 4 lawsuits in like different states, and they'll say, "See, we actually filed these lawsuits, so we're not joking, you know, we'll really sue you." So like 4 out of like 10,000 people's information they file. And then if those people if they don't settle, then they'll just dismiss the lawsuits. But
they'll hope to go for a default judgment because like, people won't respond.
Right, uniformly they will dismiss them. So they haven't litigated a single one, at least initially here in the United States. Now, recently with Malibu Media, I believe
they had a bellwether case, which didn't turn out so well because the person at the heart of it actually was guilty and actually did try and spoil evidence, and so he was hit rather hard with that.
A bellwether case is sort of a legal jargon for just a test case. And so really, since these cases hadn't gone forward, the judge wanted to have a test case. And so it actually kind of wasn't a true bellwether because the defendant admitted liability.
Yeah, just before the case started. So.
Right.
So it's kind of a weird one, but they like to use that as a... they actually tried to use my site, Torrent Freak. On news report on it, they said, see, look, go to this website. Even they'll tell you that these defendants get $10,000, $20,000 in damages against them when they go to court. You want to settle up now. We didn't like that. We changed the page on the that link went to, right as we were told about it, and we turned it into a how-to guide as to how to defend against those sorts of things. So instead of getting the kind of demands they wanted, they ended up getting giving all their potential victims a guide as to what the letter they just sent out actually was, and what they can do and can't do and shouldn't do, and what they have, and they didn't like that at all. Traffic to that page has actually dropped to zero. They're not sending on letters anymore. They don't try and use us anymore as their scare machine.
And then the company, German company, I believe their name is Guardale. And so this is part, they're supposedly working with Malibu Media, my understanding, anyhow.
Yeah. Malibu Media, for those who don't know, is XArt and a few others. That's their company. It's based out of a house in Malibu, hence the name.
Right. And so they're obviously a porn company. That's another theme, is that these lawsuits almost invariably involve pornography. Because that increases the likelihood that people want to settle just out of the embarrassment factor.
I mean, who wants to say, if I go to you and your neighbor and say, you download this extreme porn, give us money or I'm going to tell your neighbors and it's going to be in the court records and everybody's going to know. Are you more likely to give me money than if I said, you've been downloading a pinball game? And I mean, it's going to be really extreme porn. I mean, it's going to be, you know, animals and four guys and a bottle of lube and something like that. The more extreme, you know, the more likely you are to pay, because you don't want it associated in the court documents. People are going to look you up. You know, you go for a job interview. Oh, here's this court document. Oh, you've been what? You do that?
Well,
I don't mean to pick on you specifically. You just right there.
One of my first clients, it was actually a female, and she contacted me, and it was like the name of the work was like Teenage Anal Nightmare
17.
Two. So I was joking, you know, maybe the sequel. Apparently the first one was good and then the second one. So, but yeah, you get a lot of outlandish stuff like that. And people, I get clients, past clients, you know, one guy, he's in seminary school or something, and he had an unsecured wireless network. Another is like a laundromat, they had an unsecured wireless network, and all sorts of different situations where it's really implausible that they're the ones that did it, you know. So, but it does not matter to, like, at least the beginnings of this business model for these people. They'll just send out the letters and say, we don't care, we don't have time to
actually bother,
hear about your case and evaluate you individually. We're just out there, you know, to mass get these settlements. So
yeah, it's just a business. It's just a way of collecting money, and the more likely they are to anything they can do to make it more likely they'll collect is what they'll do. Hang on, John, you got a question back here? Let's throw the microphone.
So say you get one of these calls or letters, what have you, how would one actually deal with it? Should you just ignore it? Will it go away?
It depends on the letter, really. If it's like the email through your ISP, then it's nothing to worry about. If it's a court thing, don't just ignore it.
Is the
best first piece of advice.
Yeah, I would say just as a general rule, that's always or usually a good option, but I would always speak to an attorney, because a lot of the times what I tell people is that it depends on the jurisdiction. So in Georgia, I'll look at, like, in telling a client what they should do, I'll say, okay, they've filed zero cases in Georgia. I've gotten 50 people who have contacted me. I'm not going to tell you their names, but... I've gotten 50 people who have contacted me. They've filed zero cases. They're bluffing. You know,
they just want the money.
That's my legal opinion, is that they're bluffing, and that the stuff they say in the letter you shouldn't take literally. But if they're in another jurisdiction like D.C., or other states where they filed in all these cases, then I'll say you need to talk to an attorney in that state and see their thoughts on the likelihood and whatnot. And I think it depends on who the plaintiff is too. So, like, they kind of come in like different flavors, these trolling operations. So you get the ones who are really shysty, who are really bad, who really abuse things, who really pressure people into settling. And then Malibu Media is sort of on the fence, although stuff is starting to come out about tech that, like, it could be this whole...
Yeah, we'll get to the tech and the detection system
so,
in a little bit.
I would speak to an attorney. Usually they'll give you a free consultation or something.
Okay.
A good one will. Yeah. A good one will give you a free consultation.
Awesome. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're at the... Now, the thing to remember is... If they go to court and they lose, that's a huge, going to be a huge dent, not just for the money they can get from you, but because then it's a case you can use to refer to when it comes to and say, look, they had this case, they're the same kind of circumstances, and they lost. So, you know, it's, they don't want to lose because it's a, precedent. It's a, it's evidence that they can be used ahead of time to dismiss it even earlier. And then...
So they're only going to take it to court if they think
they're able to... They'll often take it to court if they think you're not going to respond. If they think they can get away with a case and a default judgment, especially. If you then... And there is a case... Where, Patel?
Oh, Patel? This case has been going on for about...
Well, it started off as a
DC. It was a case filed in DC, and that's how they obtained my client's information. I mean, I can't go into all the details. Obviously, generically, a case was filed here in Georgia, and he did not respond. And then
they're
going to get a default judgment, and then he retained me, and I filed a motion to set aside the default.
Judges hate default judgments, right?
A default is basically you lose your case, and so you don't respond to the complaint in time, then everything in the complaint is deemed admitted and they win. And so at that point, he retained me, and I filed a notice of appearance on his behalf, and we moved to set aside the default. And at that point, they just dismissed the whole thing, which is exactly what they've been doing across the country. So they were hoping to use him basically as an example, of somebody they got a default against to get news coverage and maybe put his name in some settlement letter or something to future people. And so that case has been going on. And what happened is we filed a motion for sanctions kind of based on the fact that he is one example in this huge nationwide business model. And we actually got some discovery and uncovered a lot of really interesting stuff. I think it'd be worthwhile going into all the details, but the copyright holders, are shell companies. The people representing these companies are also the officers of their clients, so they're representing themselves. and go on and on and on and on. It's big, the brother who did the tech supposedly detected this stuff is the brother of the partner of the law firm who also is the owner of the client, and it goes on and on.
It's a big, big mess. Lots of virtual ink spilled over these cases, especially this one has gotten a lot of press.
Yeah, and I mean, you could find more details on my website if you're interested, but the Prenda Law is the entity that we've been dealing with. The plaintiff is AF Holdings, and they've been sanctioned multiple times around the country now for their behavior, lying to courts, just outright courts have said, you're lying to us. We're sanctioning you $200,000 or whatever.
I think.
But and one article.
Totals that are about 800,000 that they've had in sanctions now?
I'm not sure the exact total. A recent sanction was just awarded for $200,000. So
you know what? I'm going to look it up. And I can do that because I have a little wiki about it.
So that was sort of the first wave of these kind of lawsuits. Malibu Media is sort of the next generation in a way. We'll see if they're actual. The main thing is the tech, which I think Andrew can talk about a little bit more. The main concern, I think, on that side of things is that the tech isn't reliable. And so in these settlement letters and in these lawsuits, they're making all these wild allegations about how, you know, we know it was you and that kind of thing. But an IP address, for example, doesn't equal a person. You know, it just refers to your router, or people have unsecured routers and all these different fact scenarios. So that's been one of the challenges, I guess, in working with these cases, is making judges understand that, you know, who have been sitting on the bench for 60 years. And, you know, so anyhow, Andrew, do you want to go into a little bit more on the tech side?
Yeah, sure. I'm just pulling up the monetary awards so far.
And Andrew is going to possibly be an expert in one of my client's cases, too. So yeah.
Total awards, fees, and sanctions so far is $558,255.36. So far, they have paid $35,806.93, with another $500,000 in bonds paid.
Oh, the bonds, okay.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then they've been actually sanctioned, well, local council has been sanctioned in my client's case, but the court hasn't determined an amount yet. And there may be more sanctions based on some other things as well coming. So.
And that's the other problem with these cases, they can take a long time. The Jamie Thomas trial, one of the most famous, the $1.92 million case, that took, the infringement happened in 2004 or 5, and that case was going up. Was still ongoing as of like a year or two ago, so it could take a long, long time. Joel Tenenbaum start was 2004, and that was going until 2 years ago, so it can take 7-8 years sometimes. So civil cases go slowly. The tech system. Okay, how many of you have used BitTorrent?
For how many legal purposes, have, right?
Well, of course, we all have to download Linux ISOs, and of course, the audio from this track will be released as a torrent file and on the Pirate Bay, as is my book, available as a torrent file from the Pirate Bay. You've all seen the peers list, which shows all the different IPs of all the different people you're connected to. That's their evidence, essentially. They've basically got a screenshot or had the client log every connection it's made and transferred a little bit, and hey, judge, that's our evidence. That's their proof. That's how expert they are in most things. As far as we know, because none of their systems have ever been independently audited. Even the Copyright Center 6-strike system that the major ISPs have all signed up to has never been independently audited. They had an audit, but it turned out the guy who was doing it was an industry lobbyist or worked for an industry lobby firm a few years earlier. There has been a second audit done, but that's not come out yet, and the Six Strikes program's 2 years old at this point.
Does everybody here know what the Six Strike program is?
Okay, the Six Strikes program is basically this company, DigiProtect, also operates under a couple of different names, sub-companies, sub-units, etc. We'll go out and monitor BitTorrent swarms, and if it detects you've been infringing a file, it'll send this notice through its own database thing to your ISP. And the six major ISPs, Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, I think Cox, Time Warner, I don't think Charter signed up to it now. Thankfully, I just moved to Charter from AT&T. But they'll send these notices, and it'll be an automated system, and it goes against your record. And after six strikes, they wanted to try and cut you off, but they can't cut you off. So instead, they'll reduce your speed, for instance, and after three strikes, you'll have to do like a questionnaire. And it was supposed to be you get this instead of a lawsuit, but recently one of the industry groups filed a lawsuit to force the ISP to disclose the name of this of account holders who've received three separate notifications, three strikes. And that's not nice and plain bold, not what this memorandum of agreement was. It's not a law. It was entirely voluntary between the ISPs and this industry body. But that's what the Six Strikes program is. We did a panel on it 2 years ago, and actually, my very first panel here at DragonCon was on the precursor project, the Three Strikes one, back in 2010. We had a question over there.
Do they notify you each time you get a strike?
Yes.
Or is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's sort of the same tech they're trying to assert in these cases, I think.
Yeah. The problem is, how reliable do you think their evidence is? What they're basically submitting to a court is a text file. How easy is it to change a text file? How easy is it to change, even if they take a screenshot of you allegedly doing it, how easy is it to change an image with some numbers? Copy and paste some numbers.
For example, one thing that, you know, when we're on the verge of maybe confronting one of these witnesses, but then they just dismissed everything, of course, but we were looking into, you know, the time issues. I think Andrew and I talked about it, you and I talked about this, about, you know, the logs and whether the program itself actually has an accurate timestamp and how that's oftentimes incorrect, or the different time zones, and like, you know, IP addresses are dynamic, and so at any particular time it could be different from 10 minutes later. You know, they're frequently reassigned, and people turn off their computers and they're given to other subscribers and that kind of thing. So there's all sorts of possibilities like that the judge is not going to be aware of unless they're have a background in tech,
which,
you know,
most judges don't.
Right. Yeah. And you're expected to explain stuff like that. They can't expect to know everything in the universe. So, but then they'll file these motions for discovery, and they'll include a declaration from this expert, you know, trying just very poorly written and supported declaration saying, oh yeah, here's the IP addresses. Our tech is great. You know, we need discovery on 10,000 people, and the court, like, grants it in certain jurisdictions. So, you want to talk, you know, about Guardelay? I don't know that much about Guardelay, but that's a German company that's supposedly doing this for Malibu Media.
They're all basically the same, but
right.
If you just, you know, copy out the thing, that's all their evidence is, and that's all the evidence they want to use to convict you and to get, you know, between $750,000 and $150,000 in damages from you just on a screenshot that anybody in this room could mock up and make a complete fabrication on.
And it's interesting too, because the nature of the BitTorrent protocol is you have to give information to receive it. But I believe there are certain variations. There have been ways around it, but
in fact, there was a case where somebody sued on, I don't think it was BitTorrent, I think it was the Fast Track Network with Kazaa. Do people remember Kazaa? Few years back, somebody was using a heavily modified client that didn't upload, but this company was very shoddy in their evidence collection. They claimed they did, but all they did was spot the client. They didn't actually upload anything because it was a leeching client. All it did was download it, never uploaded, and the offense that they go for is in distribution, the upload.
Well, that matters, because if they're distributing their own copyrighted work, and they don't have.
Well, no, it was the fact that the defendant didn't upload a single byte. It was modified so it couldn't upload anything.
Oh, I understand, but I'm trying to discuss like this, the general idea though, that if the copyright owner is the one uploading the stuff, then they lose basically the ability to sue on it. I'm sorry, there's a question right there.
Yeah, my question is along that same line. A friend of mine got a letter from AT&T for downloading Godzilla, and it sounded like it came from AT&T, and AT&T was doing the monitoring and the policing and not the copyright holder of Godzilla.
Okay.
And so he said he did it with BitTorrent, and he said, well, they had to be uploading themselves in order to be on that torrent, and I think that's what you're saying, is they're participating in it.
No. Not so much. Was it an actual letter or was it an email?
I would say I wouldn't put it past that being a possibility. And the reason why, let me just briefly in 1 minute explain, is that in my client's case and these guys, we uncovered evidence that they had uploaded the works themselves to the Pirate Bay in order to encourage people to download it and then foster these lawsuits.
Well, at least that's the indication we got.
It's not 100% lock proof, but that's why I say
yeah.
That's something that if you have a case like that, you would need to look at the tech and determine whether it's sufficient, they're not uploading and contributing to the infringement themselves. So,
well, that's more for the porn stuff, especially where they really cut corners to make as much money as they can. But with the Godzilla, it's less likely that they're doing it. They've probably had an outside company to monitor, which all they'll do is they'll monitor it and they'll try and, you can modify clients to just request data, a leecher client. So what it sounded like is they've gotten somebody and they've requested a tiny bit. You know, if you're talking a 700 meg video file, and it's broken down in BitTorrent into chunks, they're called pieces, and they're maybe 1 megabyte. And each of those 1 megabyte pieces is what is checked for accuracy. That's what makes BitTorrent so useful, is that each of those small pieces is checked for accuracy cryptographically with a cryptographic hash. And then if it's bad, it gets thrown away and re-downloaded. Well, each of those things is downloaded, is split into 16 kilobyte chunks, which is the smallest package of data that BitTorrent deals with. So you could have a 1 megabyte file with 16 kilobyte chunks, that'd be 256, I think, or is it 64? It's Monday lunchtime, Con. Ignore my maths. But so you could download it from like 64 different people at the same time, each in 16 kilobyte chunks. They may have just pulled one 16 kilobyte chunk from your friend and used that, and that's the limit of their evidence.
Right.
And there are arguments legally that may not be enough because it wasn't a full copy that they got from you.
Well, like one of the first like broad elements, and there are sub elements, but like the way we say is like elements for copyright infringement is making a copy. So is one 16 kilobyte chunk a copy?
You know, and then, but they're like saying that quarter of a frame.
For a split second, we observe this IP address downloading this file. They don't say that they downloaded the entire file, or that they sat on there and monitored it for 10 minutes or even an hour or whatever. They just say at a certain time, down to the second, you know, we detected this IP address, and that's what they're relying on to get 10,000 people's personal information. So that's the big problem. And that's what that signifies, probably, is if you got an email from your ISP, then it was most likely detected from the copyright owner or the shell company that purports to be the copyright
owner. Well, with the Godzilla.
With Godzilla, it's most likely the copyright owner.
Yeah.
But if you're dealing with his other ones, then yeah.
But for it to go to court, they also have to work with the AT&T lawyers and copyright lawyers and all that.
They've got their own copyright lawyers. They'll file the suit. They'll file the initial suit against a John Doe, and then they'll serve an ex parte discovery motion against AT&T. He'll end up giving them the information as part of the discovery, and then they'll use that information to send the letter. Now, in this case, because the letter came through AT&T, it seems like they've sent a notice to AT&T, and AT&T's just forwarding it on. But no ISP does monitoring themselves. It's one of the biggest things people say, oh, Comcast sent me this letter, they've detected me downloading. No. ISPs do not download.
What happens, though, is that they have this arrangement with copyright owners or supposed owners where they get a small fee for every one of these emails that they forward to subscribers.
So much.
So that's just, you know, we're just complying with the law, but yeah, we're getting paid to
That's the big one, because they have to deal with so many. So they've actually got the pay thing, so they'll actually send less to them, because it's going to cost the companies. They can't send a million in because it'll cost them $1 million, but they can afford to send 1,000 because it'll only cost them $1,000. So it's actually to cut down on that, the pay thing.
So they'll forward an email to a subscriber, and they have it set up that way. Then they'll charge, you know, whatever, $50 or $100. Well, it's 5 minutes work. So they're, you know, that's the incentive there to do that.
And it used to be a lot sloppier. There's a great story about 7 years ago. It's called the University of Washington. A thing called the DMCA study. And they took BitTorrent and they spoofed some IPs, which they sent to the tracker. And they weren't sharing anything, but what they spoofed was one of the network printer's IP addresses, and said that the network printer was sharing things. Well, don't you just know it? They put it onto, I think it was 80,000 different BitTorrent hashes, and they got, gosh darn it, wouldn't you know it, they got 192 DMCA notices that this printer was sharing this BitTorrent file. No, it wasn't. The trackers said it was. They didn't verify any kind of data download. They didn't even verify the IP address just existed. It only existed on the tracker. They just pulled the tracker list and sent it out. So they used to be even sloppier, but they still have very little evidence, which is why they don't allow people like me to independently audit their software and their methods to show that it actually works, it's verifiable. And they try and they try and they just won't let us do it. We have a question right here at the front.
Thanks. I used to use ProtoWall to filter IP addresses, and then I got a computer with Windows 7, and ProtoWall doesn't work in Windows 7. Can you suggest an alternative piece of software? I haven't used BitTorrent since because I can't filter IP addresses anymore.
Why would you want to filter IP addresses?
To keep the bad guys from downloading from me.
Okay. Who identifies the bad guys?
Independent researchers. And
no,
they publish lists of IP ranges.
So you want to
It's the block list problem. The problem is anybody can be an anti-piracy investigator. I could be right now. I could use that IP address for our router here. Would that show on your list? No, it wouldn't. There is no way to actually detect if an IP is an anti-piracy thing to make those lists. Those lists are basically people going, hey, that looks suspicious, that looks suspicious, that looks suspicious, and they just bung it on. Oh, that guy, that website trashes us. They point out all the problems with our list. We'll put them on the list. We'll say that they're a suspected thing. They put uTorrent, BitTorrent Inc., they're on the list because they had a deal at one point with the MPAA to actually sell movies through their own BitTorrent store. They had a contract with the MPAA, therefore they're going to, their client must monitor all your IP addresses, therefore they're working with anti-piracy. The lists are bogus. The lists are complete junk. Don't bother with them. In fact, the same University of Washington study did two batches. And the first one they did with the DMCA notices like that. The second one, they did it on computers running the block list software. The most popular one at the time was by a company called BlueTac Internet Security Solutions, or BIS, or otherwise known as BlueTac. The number of notices, the frequency of notices, doubled when using those lists. Because if I'm an anti-piracy researcher, I'm going to pull that list as soon as they're out. I'm going to look at that list to see if my IP's on it. If my IP's on it, what am I going to do? Change my IP. Now, you've got those lists actually covered 1/3 of the internet. And so now, you're blocking 1/3 of the internet. I'm in the 2/3 you're not blocking. You're now, 50% more likely to hit, for me to hit you, because you're going to try and connect to me and not a safe one. So those lists don't work. I'm actually on those block lists. They don't like me because I've pointed out this error a number of times. They're just a company that goes for money. They used to have a donation bar on the side that said, yeah, we're really in need of desk or donations. Then they stopped taking off the month that they're collecting the donations for. And then they stopped showing the bar at all. They're also a hidden company. They say, we're hiding from people. They're hiding from you, so you don't know who they are. They're run by a anonymous office. I can't think of the name. It's like a virtual office building that's shared with three different law firms and run at a next to a university that often does a lot of anti-piracy research in the south of England. So those block lists, don't bother with them. They don't work. They never have. They never will. I'll let you in a little secret. In the late 90s, I used to work for a record company. I used to be a copyright enforcer for a record company.
You never told me that, Andrew. So
I'm sure it's in. I think it's in my book, in my bio. But
oh, okay.
You should have read my book.
Nah, I read that book.
But I dealt with commercial music piracy, mainly, you know, people doing covers and then selling them at their gigs, that sort of thing. But one of the things when we communicated, and this was right when Napster was just coming out, late 90s, and things was, blocklists were being tried then. We all knew, working for the different record companies and the thing, that they didn't work. It was an open secret then that they were junk, and encourage people to use them, because then you're more likely to be found on them, and that was 15 years ago. So they don't work, they never have worked. The only people who want them to tell you they work are the people who benefit from them. So just don't bother with the block lists and save yourself the time and the hassle.
Are there any ways to watch IP addresses for characteristics? I think, didn't you and I discuss some of that stuff where...
Yeah.
When we were going through IP address by IP address?
It's...
I mean, if you want to do it manually, I don't know if you can do that.
You have to do it manually, and you have to know exactly what you're looking for, and you have to actually monitor them for several hours at a time. And let's put it this way. Does anybody here use DHT in their BitTorrent clients? Distributed hash table, it means you don't have to use trackers. You can use, all the clients kind of make that an ad hoc network that they pull things. About 3 years ago, I did a 1 minute capture of what my client could see on DHT. It was 78,000 IP addresses, BitTorrent entries. That's how much traffic there is in the BitTorrent network. And to try and monitor even a tiny fraction of those for a number of hours to see any kind of pattern, you know, it's hard. And you just can't do it. The block list strategy just doesn't work. And even trying to identify clients that are bad, unless you have a strong suspicion to begin with, and you're then going to have to spend 8 to 10 hours per IP address to monitor them, these list companies and stuff just aren't going to happen. You have to have strong evidence. We found those ones out because it was, you know, half a dozen email addresses.
Multiple cases point out this IP address that kept coming up. And so it was involved with, like, uploading the work to the Pirate Bay.
Yeah.
And it also, so I subpoenaed the GoDaddy records for certain people, for herein shall never be named. anyhow, so served subpoenas on GoDaddy, and it turns out that the same IP address is showing up on these people's internet accounts here. And the same people are the attorneys for this law firm, and the same people are the people who own the companies, who are the clients of the law firms that they're the owners of, etc. So this is this one case still.
And then and only then we could then monitor those IP addresses and see these kinds of behaviors, because we had the information we needed to begin with. You can't work from it backwards, because it's just too much to do.
It's labor intensive too, and then just the sheer data you have to collect. So that's another problem with these cases, is that you have to collect a massive amount of data. Even just in a text file, it accumulates really fast. But all the IP addresses involved to make sure that, you know, these people are connected and downloading the entire work, not just for a split second or whatever. So, and that was another problem I believe you said you ran into, is the sheer amount of the data, just in megabytes. So
if you do torrent, what is the best way to torrent? If you have any...
Okay. I get this question every year. How do I do it?
I will tell you that if you want to be safe from any kind of hackers or attackers who may want to try and compromise your systems in any way, shape, form, or fashion on any protocol, a VPN is always good for any activity you do online. It'll then redirect your outgoing IP address to the exit of the VPN. It's just a tunnel. You connect to this and it's an encrypted tunnel, and you appear to be coming out somewhere else. And a lot of these VPN companies, for your own safety and security, so that you don't get attacked, will not keep logs. So they don't keep logs of who was actually active and using which IP address and which IP addresses they were connecting. So it's an encrypted proxy, effectively, with no logs. And it is always good for any kind of secure activity that you may wish to keep secured.
And it depends, there are multiple VPNs out there too. And so usually there are websites which you can find out like the policies on data retention exactly.
Torrent Freak doesn't.
Every six months
we run a guide, and we're actually going to update our systems on that in the next month or so.
Some of the VPNs you do need to do some basic research, because at the end of the day, some of them have actually misrepresented to their customers how strenuous their retention is and everything, and data has ended up being turned over for whatever reason.
Yeah. Who heard about the Sarah Palin email leak? The email hack. Right. The guy did it, used a free VPN. They logged. They got the feds involved. The feds got involved. They turned over the data. That's how they got him. Because the VPN logged. So many good VPNs will not log, just for the safety of their own users, because any log that they keep could always be attacked and hijacked that way. So for people's safety and security, they just don't keep logs.
It depends on jurisdiction, too. Some jurisdictions will require data retention. So,
well, get any in Europe, because the European Union just overturned the European Data Retention Directive, thanks to the Pirate Party championing it.
Oh, gosh.
I'm promoting my book, shut up.
When's the sequel coming out? Come on, you've been talking about that for a while.
Yeah, the sequel comes out when I have time to finish it.
I'm waiting on bated breath, I guess.
Okay, so going through this, the data, we've still got 10 minutes or so left. Anybody else got any more questions?
Gentlemen.
You have any thoughts on the safety of cloud?
It's not safe. Yeah. Mega Upload showed a lot of the problems with the cloud. If anybody knows Mega Upload, it was a cloud storage system run by a guy called Kim Schmidt, or Kim.com, as he liked to be called, a German entrepreneur and convicted fraudster now living, who was running Mega Upload, which is a Hong Kong company, but he was living in New Zealand, in one of the biggest mansions in New Zealand. And I think it was 2 years ago, he was raided by the New Zealand Counterterrorism Force after a request by the FBI for money laundering, among other things, and massive copyright infringement. They took all his assets, including all his flash cars, his all his money, thing, and they basically took down Mega Upload, and there were something like 1,300 servers at Carpathia Hosting in Virginia, which is where the original indictment was filed under U.S. Attorney Daryl McBride. The FBI was involved, and all the data was there. And if you were a Mega Upload subscriber and you had data on the cloud, you couldn't access it. It was gone. And instead, it was sitting in that data center, disconnected, and the feds could pour through at any time.
I remember they blocked his
access. No, they pulled the servers out entirely.
And they wouldn't let him buy it.
Well, that's... They wouldn't let him buy... That's it. That's coming on.
And eventually, they gave some people some information back, I believe.
No, not yet.
They haven't given any information
back? There's one guy, he was sued. He sued the federal government to gain access to it, because they're claiming it's all evidence and so can't be resold. But the hosting company, who's not being paid, can freely delete at any time because the government's got the data they want. And this guy who's suing because he had a hard drive crash. He was a sports photographer, and he had a hard drive crash a day or two after the Mega Upload raid. And so the backups he had locally are gone. The only ones he had then were the backups on the cloud. And now he can't access them either. And that's been 2 years, and he's still waiting to get his data back for his livelihood. So the cloud is great as long as you've got multiple reliable backups and the data is non-critical and non-privacy sensitive. So if all those conditions are met, the cloud's fine. I use it for my images when I'm working on articles for Dropbox. But that's about it.
Yeah,
Is there a particular VPN that you would use, and are there any decent free ones?
You get what you pay for.
Okay.
Is the first thing. I don't actually use any myself at present. I'm working on, well, Torrent Freak's always reviewing and researching VPNs, so I can't tell you any one right now, because I've been through so many over the past couple of months that I've no idea which ones are even which anymore. They're all written down in notes and they'll be on the site, so I couldn't tell you any specifics, but we have a guide. It's you look Google Torrent Freak VPN reviews, it'll show what the have good privacy policies.
Cool.
Anyone else?
Who here has used a VPN? I'm just curious, just as a general matter. Oh, wow.
A lot of people use VPNs.
All right.
All right, then another thing. Pet peeve of mine. Does anybody use private trackers? Or know what they are? Anybody? All right, let's less incriminating, because there's a video camera going. Does anybody know what a private BitTorrent tracker is? No, you don't. There is absolutely nothing private about it. In fact, it is the most data logging method possible. The reason it's called a private BitTorrent tracker, again, goes back to DHT. So we're about privacy, so let's talk about that real quick. It's DHT is a distributed network thing. There used to be a thing called a community tracker or a registration tracker, where in order to keep speeds high and foster a community, they had this little tracker and you had to be a member to use it, and that was great. Then DHT came along, and that meant any client could connect to any other client in this big ad hoc kind of cloud-like search system, and all of a sudden these community trackers, anybody could use the link and get the data from them and not be a member of the community. Not good. So they begged the BitTorrent protocol to be changed and have a little thing added to it. And if this little thing was added to it, then DHT couldn't be used on that torrent. And to make sure it changed the hash, which is the SHA-1 cryptographic hash of the hashes of the data. So you couldn't use it, turn the flag off and use it anyway. Well, that flag ended up being called the private flag, as in, don't go announcing that you're sharing this torrent publicly on DHT. So, hey, we got these torrents. They're flagged private. Let's call them private torrents. Okay, what do we call a site that has private torrent on them? Let's call them a private tracker. So now you've got these sites where you have to go and you have to provide your email, you have to provide a username, you have to log in every time with your IP address, you have to abide by several very restrictive things, you often have to have an interview to even get on it. They get social engineer information out of you. And what they don't tell you is, they store all of that information in a database, and they share it with other sites. There is actually a prism, basically, of private tracker users. It's not private. Not in the slightest. Anybody saw Revenge of the Sith, the third Star Wars Episode 3? There was a workprint release just before the world premiere of it. It went to a site called Elite Torrents, which was one of the top tier private trackers. Within a week of it going up, three of the guys were in federal custody. The site was taken down, the whole lot raided. It was so fast because there were people on the inside. There's always going to be people on the inside, and you've given them lots more information. What does a lawyer always want when having a case? More information, right? They want to have an airtight bulletproof case.
Sometimes I don't want my client to tell me what's going on. That's what.
If you're prosecuting a case like that, though, you want more information as possible.
Well,
right?
Sure. You want to get evidence. Absolutely.
And in the Jamie Thomas case, what was the one crucial piece of evidence? Remember? It was her username that she used, TerrorStar. Because she used that email, that username on the Kazaa that she used for the thing. And she used it on her email. And she used it here, and she used it there. And that associated heard the account with her other accounts that were hers. And that was the biggest link. She couldn't say, oh, it's somebody on my Wi-Fi. You know, oh, it's somebody using a Trojan. They've got a backdoor access to my computer and they're just, you know, bouncing through my computer and using me as effectively a VPN. No. They got her personal identifiable information, her username, and that was the key piece of evidence to convict her, to get the judgment from her, right? Yep. A civil case.
Yep.
So usernames, private sites, big no-no, not private. Yep. Okay. Any more questions? Thoughts?
At some point, Demonoid went down. They were a very popular tracker at some point in time.
Yeah, Demonoid hates me.
I'm sure. I've become aware that it's now back up, but nobody knows the nature of the ownership, where the servers are located, anything that's going on. Do you have any... The general consensus that I've read toward it is that it's a honeypot, and just for collecting further information. Do you have any idea what's going on?
It depends. You ask the Demonoid staff, they'll say no. We don't, but this has actually happened before. It happened in, 2007. It went down for about 6 months, and we at Torrent Freak said, you know, it's gone down, this has happened, and staff said, no, they're not, Torrent Freak are liars, ignore them, everybody at Demonoid, they're liars, they're scum, they don't know what they're talking about, they're making up to make money. 6 months later, it comes up, guess what? We were spot on. Same thing happened again, as you say, it was about 2 years ago, I think now, wasn't it, that it went down, and it came back up 3-4 months back, I think it started coming back up. We ran our story because we found out that some of the Ukrainian data centers that were being used have been visited by some police officers, and things have been shifted around, and one of the industry bodies had claimed they'd made an arrest of the owner, Demos, of Demonoid in Mexico. And the staff at Demonoid said, no, it's rubbish, they don't know what they're talking about, the craft. Well, it seems like we were right again, but as for whether the new one, Demonoid.ph, isn't it?
I think so.
Is that a honeypot? I don't know. I haven't had the guts to stick my hand into that particular bear trap right now. Obviously we had Dragon on here to prepare for, but it's one of the things on my to-do list, along with the second book that he'd love to see. And
I don't have anything to do with the Demonoid. I have to tell clients. No, I seriously don't, so I don't know, but I follow the stories a little bit about them going up and down. Only thing I would just say is if you must download stuff on the internet, just be careful. I get a lot of people contacting me, and it's a real threat out there, these kinds of lawsuits and stuff. But at the same time, you know, they're invading your privacy, I think, in the way they're conducting themselves. So there are ways you can protect yourself and stuff like that as well. I think that's justifiable to try and do that just in general. But yeah.
None of this is settled law. It's all been very much still the very frontiers of law. There's been very few cases that have actually gone through full litigation. Sure. So it's still one court says this, one court says that, and a lot of courts haven't actually really said anything at present. So it's very much the final frontier, or at least the unknown country.
Thank you.
And we have one last one. More. Right, quick. Sure.
I was wondering if I trade concerts, live concert recordings, band recordings. So there's lots of different sort of licenses involved in copyright and things. But the I'm wondering if there's been any cases that you know about that have gone after. And there's specific rules. The sites that I use, there's very specific rules about what can be shared. So if it's been commercially released, it can't be shared. If the band has somehow stated in some fashion that they don't like this, it can't be shared. Do you guys know anything, or has anything come up that you've run across about specifically live concert trading?
Not specifically live concert trading. There was a UK site that did a similar sort of thing with British TV. You know, nothing that was commercially released or about to be commercially released. You know, nothing, you know, the things didn't want it. They had a takedown policy, a whole lot. And a lot of actually British TV producers sometimes interacted with people through it. And it was a good way for people like myself who are British and don't live there anymore to have kept up with some TV shows and what was going on there. 2 years ago, last week, they got a letter from the Federation Against Copyright Theft. Great, it's a great name, three lies in one word, in one title. They did it without the copyright holders' things, because often industry associations have, as part of their membership agreement, that they can do it. So it doesn't actually necessarily have to be even the bands doing it, and often it's not. There's many cases of artists saying, you know, sure, share our stuff, and then say the record company or an industry association saying, hey, no, take that down, we're going to sue
you. ASCAP or BMI or Sound Exchange.
Yeah, Sound Exchange, or even the RIAA can, yeah. will stay stuff out. And,
but yeah, that is, I mean, under U.S. law anyways, live performance is something that is protected under the copyright law, so recording that would be an infringement. I mean, unless, you know, the band has given permission or they've adopted sort of Creative Commons is a self-made sort of scheme where you can authorize people to use it certain ways, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it would depend on the individual case.
But, yeah.
It seems like it's not being targeted at this time, at least.
Not at present, because it's much easier if they can do extreme porn, because, let's say, if you're being targeted for extreme porn or for a concert, which one's more likely to get you to sign up? Because you don't mind being associated with downloading, you know, Pink Floyd's The Wall, but, you know, the sort of things with the extreme porn, you don't want that getting out. Even you're just accused of it, because there's plenty of cases where communities have turned on people just for the merest hint of an accusation, however unfounded it may be. And that's what they're counting on. So, any more questions from anybody? Oh,
two more last quick ones. Time.
Do you have
time.
Any thoughts on operating systems, particularly for torrents, and do you have a preferred Linux distro for such?
You're going to hate me for saying this. I use Vista in my main system. Yeah, I actually have my main work computer is it's actually now 5.5 years old Vista installation. It's the same installation when I got the box 5.5 years ago, and it hasn't been changed since, and it works perfectly. So I only use Linux if I'm in a VM when I'm researching Linux clients, because a lot of the stuff I work with and on other projects I work with is Windows based.
Okay.
So I use it because it's there and it's available. It's not my main system, you know, what I'm only limited in. I used to work and teach in RISC-OS, for instance, in the 90s, and I interned at ARM when I was at university, so I know, you know, other systems. It's just what I'm used to, what I need from my other tools and things, so I just use mainly Windows stuff and Vista because it was on the box and I can't be bothered to change it.
Cool.
I think there's one final one back there.
Yeah. Back over here.
It sounds like your email address is also going to be used against you as well as your IP address. So would a good strategy be to dump your email addresses every now and then? Can they go back 5 years and find a closed email address and prove that it used to be yours?
Not 5 years much. Is it 6 months generally?
Generally, the ISP retention policy is 6 months.
Some can be 2 years.
There's no requirement for any period in the U.S. In other countries, I believe it depends on the jurisdiction.
But then again, there's the indirect way. If you put it on your Facebook profile,
right?
You know, I've got my email address is actually on my business cards that, you know, I've handed out here in the past. I don't have any with me today, but you know, it's this@this.co.uk. So you know, no matter what, if it's on I've gone and found email addresses from 15 years ago. I've Googled them and I've found forum posts or Usenet posts that I've made back then that identified me. It wasn't this domain, but other ones 15 years ago that identified me by name or through something else identifiable by another hop to me. So it's they can use it to identify you in any way. Should you dump it? A lot of people I know, again, I'm giving no specific advice one way or another, a lot of people I know may set up, if they were to be paranoid, specific email accounts just for certain activities. And that, for them, may seem to be the best way of handling that situation. Because, of course, I cannot advocate you to participate in any kind of illegal activity or to try and circumvent law or to try and evade detection by a certain means. So that's what other people may do for similar situations.
Not only that, but a lot of people in countries where they're persecuted politically are in need of anonymizing type stuff, too. So,
And only access it through a VPN, for instance, that doesn't log. So multiple layers, just, you know, if you do not want to be tracked by anybody nefarious, be very careful about what you do, where and when, is possibly the shortest way to put it.
Cool.
But I think that's about time. We're at 2:10, and I thank all of you, and we actually grew during the panel, which is quite surprising. I think this is the biggest crowd I ever had at this kind of time on a Monday, so I'm very pleased, and thank you all for coming, and I hope you learned something, and if not, let me know. I'm usually available, just hunt for that. Or come to the EF Track page, and you'll see my name probably at the top of most of the panel pages.
If you get a letter, give me a call, I'll help you out.
So, thank you.